Dale, I think I'll introduce you because to save you that. So Dale Williams is our, you can see he is our speaker after my first opening slot. He is our guest speaker today, and he's bringing us a wealth of experience and hopefully a different perspective. You can see the range of people that we have here. So Dale is an executive coach by current profession. But he has a huge amount of experience in the IT space. In fact, his CV says that he started programming at the age of 12. And I can just imagine what that was. It was probably like a Spectrum or the ZX81. So he has experience also with the financial services space in terms of his work at Standard Chartered. So, and now as an executive coach, obviously getting a lot of exposure to work how it's done in different areas, and particularly the overlap with the education space. So he's going to be talking to us specifically about this topic of using technology and how we can use it better in terms of our objectives. And then he's going to be, I think, with us until lunchtime. So hopefully be able to give us a different perspective on our discussion. So thanks for being here, Dale. So on that note, I'm going to hand over to Dale, who's going to go into the next session. I think we just need to switch the... Are you...
Good morning, everybody. I've met some of you. I've met all of you. I've worked with some of you before, which is nice to see some familiar faces. I've been asked to talk on using technology in actuarial tuition and assessment, which sounds very formal. It sounds like I should know something about actuarial education, which I only have a very scant understanding of. So I've reframed it as strategic developments in education technology, which is something I do know something about. And I'm hoping that with that view from myself in terms of what's going on in the world of education technology, this combination of technology and education are creating new opportunities and threats, I think, for everybody involved in any aspect of education. I think that will be quite interesting as some context for your day, and maybe just to get you thinking, and maybe some of the points I make may even be a little bit controversial, I hope so, or at least just confirm some of the things, all the tracks that you're already on. So let me just start by saying what I've been doing for the last little while, which has given me some insights into this world. So the first is I've convened a course at UCT called Strategic Thinking. So I've had some exposure to some of your students, or many of the students who go through a business science, actuarial science, and many others who do accounting and do other marketing and...
So that's come out of a classroom giving lectures, very traditional, where it was in 2007 when I started, and it's evolved, and we've used some forms of technology over time with that and introduced technology and running weekly modules and using online and ways to engage people in the classroom using technology. The second is Get Smarter, which is a company I've been involved in as an executive coach to the two founders, Sam and Rob Paddock, since 2011, and walked a journey with them from when they were 30 people to last year selling the company to 2U, which is a global education technology company, perhaps one of the foremost in the world. And actually, to this day, I'm rounding out the last of my commitments there over the next couple of months. And that's been a fascinating journey, and I'm going to layer in some of the lessons I've learned there into the things that I talk about. And then the third is the Center for Creative Leadership, which is a global executive education organization. And there, where the target market is executive education, so we're working with people such as yourselves and offering training and courses mostly in leadership, but again, how technology seeped into those environments in different shapes and forms over the years. And then underpinning, and actually which is my connection to Andrew from, I had a look at the dates, 1987 when I first met Andrew, was ISEC, where I first got exposed to education in a very multicultural and running education sessions. And in those days, the technology was quite scant. We were talking about telex machines and faxes, and we ran a global exchange program where we exchanged 6,000 people in the year using fax machines and DHL courier floppy disks. So I'm showing a little bit of my age. So through this journey, I think I've been fortunate that I've been exposed to how things have developed over the years, right from the very sort of cutting edge of what's happening with education technology now on a global scale, to you, the company that bought Get Smarter, run graduate degree programs, and they probably are, well, they are the leading OPM provider in the US, and seen in the last year in quite a depth how they operate and how they work with educational technology, has given me quite an interesting understanding of how all these pieces fit together. So I'm going to talk, I'm thinking, for about 15 minutes or so, but I'm very open, so I'm happy if you interrupt me and my 15 minutes becomes the full 45 minutes and it becomes conversational, or that we get through 10 or 15 minutes and then we have questions and answers, or we have a conversation that comes out of that. I'm very easy. Either way you want to do that. I am going to move quite quickly, and I will give you copies digitally of everything that I've got here, so you'll have it to take away. So there's some points and things, so you don't need to take notes. You will have all of that. I thought I'd focus in three areas. Firstly, just a little bit of the landscape of education technology and what's happening. Secondly, some scenarios which I've drawn out, some of the big influences that I see playing out, and this is the area which may be a little bit controversial, particularly for those in academia, in terms of how I think the routes could go. And scenarios are quite useful in saying, rather than having a plan and saying we're here and we're going to get there and this is our absolute plan, we can play out and we can say what are the different ways that this could evolve, and then for yourselves as ASSA to say, well, what would happen in that scenario? What would we do, and what would our response be? Because I think sometimes it can be a little bit daunting when you're thinking about all these changes, and I can just picking up a little bit of conversation, you know, the euphoria about data science and big data and AI in the last year, I'm sure, must have been a thing to think about from an actuarial point of view. And then how do you deal with these things, and what happens, and where do they go to, and how do you respond to them? And hopefully the scenarios can do that. And the application is what comes out in our conversation and questions and answers and anything that leads from that. So let me get into it, and I've pulled from a study from an organization called Study Portals, which it covers over 170,000 courses in 3,000 educational institutions around the world, and they basically provide information for people who are wanting to study, and what they've done is they've pulled together 8 global trends, and I'm going to run through these trends and a few other trends that I've picked up to give you a sense of what's going on in this world of higher education. So the labor market shifts and the rise of automation. So we know this a lot. I'll mention a little bit later the fourth industrial revolution, which I think you've spoken about at some point, Conrad. We had that conversation. So sort of this idea that sudden and dramatic changes as a result of technology, some of which we've seen, some of which creeps up on us over time, and then we look back and we go, oh my goodness, how did we ever live without an iPhone or without Uber or without Airbnb or all these things? And some disrupt industries, you know, such as digital photography or communication in terms of WhatsApp and cell phone providers. For, you know, so some of these things happen to us quite quickly, and some of them happen over time, and then we look back and we realize they're quite quick. So this idea of automation and what happens to all these people, which is not really an actuarial issue because I think you'll always be a very elite and niche part of the labor market, but it's still quite interesting in terms of the work that you do and how that plays out and what do these people do. So things like guaranteed minimum wages and things like that. The second trend is the economic shifts and moves towards emerging markets in higher education. So this is quite interesting because the lower middle and the upper middle countries are growing at a much higher level. So you can see from that graph the two lines that are growing significantly. The blue line in the middle is the upper income countries, and that's growing, but the upper middle and the lower middle are growing at much steeper rates in terms of tertiary education. So there's more people demanding tertiary education in those countries. The third is a growing disconnect between employer demands and college experiences, and this I think is an interesting one I'm going to pick up in the scenarios. I think if you think about the role of education, what education does is it provides people ready for employment. And there's always been a reasonably good connect between what universities provide and what employers need. And there's a growing disconnect between that, and we've seen it play out in a couple of different ways, which I'll pick up in other trends. I think that's very important to understand that, because if that disconnect gets too wide, then it creates opportunities for other people to step in and fill the breach and offer things which weren't perhaps possible in the past. I mean, it brings into question, I think it's too if you think back 5 years ago, they had, I can't remember who wrote it, one of the big consulting firms, McKinsey, I think, wrote the avalanche is coming. Some of you might have read it about sort of MOOCs and how that's going to completely decimate university education, which obviously hasn't happened. But the sort of fear that universities become irrelevant at some point, and I don't think that's what this is saying either, but it's saying there's a threat and there are people who are organizations, companies, businesses looking for opportunities and might fill the breach where universities aren't meeting those. So that's an interesting trend. The growth in urbanization and a shift towards cities. More and more people are moving to metropolitan areas, and that's affecting how what they need in terms of education. And if you think South Africanly, what in the South African context, what that does as well is it creates a... if you think regionally in terms of Africa and South Africa, the demands for education and what's relevant in South Africa is not always completely in sync with what's relevant for the world. And I think, Conrad, we had that conversation, even for actuaries, what's relevant for actuaries in South Africa, there's some demands and challenges and opportunities which are quite different to what's going on globally. And how you marry those two together is an interesting trend as this urbanization increases. This one's interesting, maybe, I'm not sure for South Africa, certainly the US at the moment, but restricted immigration policies and student mobility. So those people in those emerging markets want to study in the first world and they want to move, and it's becoming increasingly hard to move because of immigration policies. So that's it's kind of a trend which is also a tension. A lack of supply but growth in demand, so the greater demand for education, which you can see where some of those areas where there is demand, and there's a lack of supply, so new supply of education, which again is creating opportunities for other people to step in and fill that gap in terms of education. And then the rise in non-traditional students. So these are students who are particularly older. So the report estimates there will be a total of over nearly 4.5 million in the age group, over the age of 24, enrolled in the 15 high-income countries. So if you look at on a graph, you'll see some of the countries, particularly China, becoming very dominant, huge investments in education, but older people doing education, not people who are going for their first undergraduate degree at an age of 18 or 19 and going 3 or 4 or 5 years, but actually people who are older and more mature students who have a different requirement and need in terms of what they're looking for in education. This is illustrated through this idea of open loop learning, which is something which Stanford University came up with. And I'm going to just play a short clip from the head of Stanford University, John Hennessy, talking about what that is and how that plays out.
The open loop university concept, this notion that for a 4-year confined period here, but maybe go outside the university, get working experience, interesting volunteer or service experiences, and make multiple times, initially they can, but eventually, maybe for some sort of continuing professional development. This vision came out of a study that the design school did. Of course, they actually ran to challenge students to think about how education might change in the future. And it's a fascinating idea because at one level you'd say this is really what should happen. Students should be able to go out of the university, get some real life work experience. And of course, and other things do this. Even at Stanford, more than a third of our students take 5 years, but they take it because they're stopping out and going and doing something else that they're involved in. Maybe it's trying their hand on entrepreneurship, maybe it's going in project. So lots of students are opting for this already. I think the other is the notion of a lifelong student. This has become the reality, right? People want to come back. And in a time where you may not in your life anymore, in the old days, you had 1, 2, or 3 jobs during a lifetime. Now, you have a half dozen or a dozen jobs during a lifetime in 2 separate kinds of careers. I think we're going to see more and more people coming back, and we're trying to develop methods to support that, not only professional education, like saying the engineering school or medicine or where things are constantly changing and people need to come back and engage in courses, often online because people are simply too busy to come physically to a place anymore. There's a great physical gathered, but it's also much what people's work lives look like. We've also begun to think about something people might do later in their lives. People who retire now at 65 don't think they're going to retire purely a life of golf and fishing. They're interested in what they might do. They may not want something that's a normal 9 to 5 or probably more likely 7 to 8 schedule in the day, but they want to experiment with this. So our former dean of the medical school, Phil Pizzo, has started this thing called the Distinguished Careers Institute. Highly accomplished people who are looking at the next phase of what they might do in their lives. Much of it will be working in nonprofits or community service. Some of it might be coming back into the academy and using their knowledge and their experience to do that. So that's another way of thinking about how do you engage in a different way of education. Whether or not the undergraduate experience will ever span over 6 or 7 or 8 years, that's harder to predict. Because a lot of what in the undergraduate experience is social growth and development of skills for leadership and collaborative work with people. And while that could be spread out, it's a little more tricky when students form very strong social bonds with their class. It would make it harder to do that. But I think we'll see over time how it evolves.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting to think about those variations on education. I think so often we've been through an education system in a way and it looks the same and it's kind of stayed the same, and to think about how it might change and how it is changing. And then the last of these 8 points is the dwindling budgets for institutions. So research shows states in the U.S. are spending $9 billion less on states around the world on $9 billion less on higher education than they were in 2008. Other data from 2017 indicates that about 33 states accumulated revenue below their original projections, so they're not making as much money. And one of the people from Metropolitan State University in Denver said, if this continues, this trend, basically by 2025, there'll be no funding in higher education. So it'll be pretty much everyone pays for what they use. So it's quite interesting. I mean, any thoughts that you have around those trends, anything you agree with or disagree with or that you've seen in any shape or form? We're waiting down the table, really.
The thing that made me think it was the video about the open loop censored third world. I think Discovery censoring our videos, guys. I think.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea keeps coming up. The idea of could students be somehow deployed into the marketplace as they're progressing through their studies to give context to what they're learning. And it's always a difficult one because you're breaking so many norms. But on the other hand, it's one of the solutions to the problem that I have of students who are not aware, who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, don't understand the business environment, and are being taught all these things that they're learning by rote because it doesn't make any sense until they eventually sit down in the job and then try and retcon what it all meant and how it all applies. And I still haven't come up with a better way of trying to make a student understand what it will be like to work as an actuary, no matter how much we talk. And that, yeah, how do we get them into these workplaces? Some of them do VAC work, and I think that helps. But how do we get them really engaging with those things so that when they learn something, it's a solution to a problem that they've already known about, as opposed to giving them the solution and then later
it's somewhat theoretical until they've actually dealt with it. Yeah, exactly. Steve.
So on that, I'm grappling with this with our third year class. Essentially, we have the situation where we have a 4-year degree, but it's effectively a 3-year degree and an honors year, so students have to reapply. And we have a large number that don't meet the grade to come into the fourth year. And we say, go out into the workplace and come back. And there are two things we discover. Half the students don't want to go out into the workplace.
They really don't.
They're scared. And the second is that once they go out, many of them don't want to come back. Okay, so yeah, so it's a very interesting challenge that we have on that side is getting them out there and then getting them come back. And I have a different view on vacation work, and the reason I have it is that our students who have no experience in the workplace, who do go out and have a 2-week VAC job, come back highly disillusioned and often want to change degree because the experience is so bad. And I actually think we're doing a disservice to those students because everyone knows there's a discomfort factor. So when you go out, and I tell everyone, change is difficult, and it takes about 6 months to adjust to change. We see it when they go out into, they come from school into university, and they go from university into the workplace. And I think that, and I've been fighting against this for years, and people misunderstand me, I think that when we send students who have never worked before out for 2 weeks to an employer who thinks they're doing a social good and hasn't put effort into it, we actually disillusion those students, and then they come back and say, it really was bad, it wasn't what I thought, and can I change into something else? Yeah. So I think we need to think about that quite carefully.
Good, thanks. Let's take one more point, then we'll move on.
Just a question I have on other bullet points 6 yes. and 8.
Yes.
Whether you can maybe just expand a little bit on that, because they're in a way conflict for me. I mean, you've got lack of supply, which kind of makes sense if you have dwindling budgets, but you have growth in demand. So surely people are prepared to pay for education, and which says to me there's a market opportunity.
Right.
Why is there no private capital flowing into education to the extent that fills that dwindling budget for public institutions?
I mean, I think there's gaps, because in the top universities there is private capital, and they have these huge endowments which keep them very much afloat. But there are very few that fit into that category, and it's the public funding that goes into them. And I mean, it's a U.S. phenomenon, but there's an academic inflation, which is the way that the U.S. does education. They do it in quite an expensive way, more expensive than most other countries. So the inflation just keeps growing, and the government is spending less. You know, they're getting pulled in other ways. So it's more about the public funding going in terms of the support than the private. I think the universities that can get private funding are great, but not everyone gets private funding. It's harder for some universities. Good. So I wanted to then just push on and add another, some more trends, which I'm not going to go through, but I want to pick out one or two which I think are important, which is this idea of big data and machine learning and AI, which is something which, I mean, we've had an interesting experience at Get Smarter, just to tell you a story. So we've figured out that we have a lot of data, because Get Smarter is a company, we run short courses. We worked initially with UCT, we work with WITS and Stellenbosch University, and we also work now with Harvard and Cambridge and Oxford and MIT, London School of Economics and Chicago. And we run courses where we work with faculty, and they're typically courses which are not necessarily run on campus. So they're filler courses for people who want to get ahead in their career in some way and learn something. And it's interesting, the demographics. In South Africa, 50% of the people who do Get Smarter short courses don't have a degree. So it's a proxy to say they have some sort of knowledge about a particular topic, project management or internet marketing or something like that. Internationally, amongst the universities in the UK and the US, 50% of the people who take the courses have a master's degree. So it's completely reversed, and it's very interesting. So these are people who are very well accomplished, quite advanced in their career, very well academically qualified, and they're wanting to learn something around fintech or big data or artificial intelligence, which are some of the biggest courses that we've got and the most popular courses. So these are people who, from the research we've done, are typically looking to fill a gap. So it's either opportunity or fear-based. If you think of somebody who's maybe an investment banker in the UK and they've heard about this thing fintech 2 years ago, and what is it? I'm not sure what it is. I can do a course with MIT or Oxford and I can learn about it in a short period of time. It's a high-quality course. Our NPS, which is our best, NPS is how students rate you, is very high. We 40 plus, Harvard University has a 45 NPS. It's quite hard to get above zero, just as a base. So don't think about it in a scale from 0 to 100. And we have very high completion rates. So we have 92% completion rate. The people who start actually finishes the courses. But it's quite interesting. Firstly, on one side is the topics that have been really successful for us and interesting, which have been internationally, and those topics, big data, machine learning, AI. And these are people who are going to come out of the course not with a deep knowledge of it, but with just enough knowledge to complement what they're already doing. So, I mean, certainly I think we could say that's a trend in the world in terms of what the interest is. These are areas which are growing, and I liken a little bit to what the internet was like in the 1990s. It was kind of this explosive area of new things, and of course everything predicted won't take place and it won't change the world as dramatically as we think it will, and yet there will be some superb, some significant disruptive changes. If you think of what came out of the 1990s dot-com, which almost 80-90% of the companies failed, but out of it came the Amazons and the Googles and the Apples and a few outliers and Facebook a little bit later, which just have dominated the world in many ways. So the thing I think to think about these trends is things like big data, machine learning, AI are interesting. They're not going to probably change the world as much as we say they are that you read in U magazine, but they probably will change the world in terms of certain things will make fundamental shifts in the way that we think and the way that we work. other trends, and what I did was I scanned a whole bunch of publications inside higher education and a number of others, and pulled out some of the trends that were repeated over and over. Increased interaction, so how you interact with people. Technology, we've learnt as well by creating a pedagogy which is very engaging, where people work in groups, they solve problems together, and the technology is all there to do that today. So there's almost no limits on it, and it's only been quite recent. If you think about, we had Skype 3 years ago, we've got Google Hangouts in the last 2 years, Zoom in the last year to year and a half has become fairly common everywhere, and you can quite comfortably, we will be in a Zoom conversation with 6 or 8 people anywhere in the world, and it will be like in the room, and you can sit and talk for an hour or two very comfortably, not like the old video conference that it used to be 10 years ago. So this allows for different interaction and increased interaction across borders and cultures and all sorts of other things. Education inflation I mentioned. The interesting one which came up in a couple of places was by 2030, 85% of the jobs in the world will be new. So there will be jobs that just don't exist in the world. And so, I mean, listening to your conversation about designations, for me is quite interesting to go, kind of what are those forces that are going to pull at the actuarial designations in shapes and forms and going to kind of splinter off bits and pieces, maybe, and offer parts of it which aren't nearly as completed as what they are now. But perhaps some of these trends are going to impact that in some way and how you think about those. And I think strategically you've always got to think, you know, do you resist, do you try and counter, or do you try and run with it and shape it in some way? And I mean, those are three quite different strategies in terms of how you actually deal with these things. Lifelong learning, we've mentioned. Asia EdTech, I mean, this is incredible in that Asia is probably likely, and it's a little bit blind to us because we're quite Western-focused, Europe, USA, probably a lot in terms of education technology. But 54% of the world's education technology is likely to come out of Asia within the next 2 years. The MOOCs, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the massively open online content, which was this big thing that was going to disrupt, those companies are trying to reinvent themselves now and trying to say, how do we commercialize these and build businesses? And they've changed. And while they still provide access to many people to education, they wouldn't have, I don't see them as a big threat in any way to universities. It's like I remember at UCT 4 or 5 years ago speaking to all the heads of departments, and it was a little bit of paranoia in the air, like where are we going to be and what's this going to be? And I think that's one of those things with these trends that you have to think about is say, in and of itself, the one thing predicted is not going to play out, but what are the ancillary things that come out of it? Like out of .com came, you know, Facebook and Google, which changed the way we do many things. What are those things, and try and look for those, because I think those are the things that are going to impact us and we have to think about. The reduced cost of technology and availability of technology, and I'll talk about that more in the scenarios, and we've spoken about the Lifelong Loop University. I just threw this in. I don't want to talk about it too much. The fourth industrial revolution, really just they've conceptualized it quite well. And what's quite useful in it, if you want to dig into it, is to look at which jobs get affected and over what time. And they've used the World Economic Forum network to research it with all the members to say which are the jobs most likely to be affected and by when. How will they be disrupted? And that's quite interesting. But it looks at it from business, government, people, all the different stakeholders, and how this technology change is likely to cause changes for all those different stakeholders. And I think that's definitely worth digging into. I'm absolutely not going to go through any detail, but I thought this was interesting. 90-plus EdTech companies writing the future of education. That's how many businesses are out there thinking about education and building businesses on the back of education, which is very interesting. So if you think about where education has and was, I mean, education institutions are some of the oldest in the world. They've owned education, and it's really been the remit of tertiary education organizations, universities, that have owned education. And now you have all these people playing in the space, and you can see it as threat or opportunity. Some universities, and I'll talk about that in scenarios, some of, you know, almost rejected. It's very political in the U.S. In terms of the space and people making money out of education, particularly between public and private funded universities. But I thought just interesting for the awareness of this group, these are all the people playing in the world, and these are the ones known. These are not the startups in the garage. These are people who listed, raised a couple of rounds of finance. They're actually out there. They have revenues. They have a business. So it's a busy space. So what I thought I'd do then, just to finish off, is to ask the question, what will educational technology look like in 2030? And what I've done is I've looked at all of those different variables and I've distilled them down, and we could argue about it, and if we had more time and we were doing this as a strategy session, we might debate it and come up, you might come up with different things. So I'm very open for you to challenge and you may frame it differently. But what I thought about was, I thought, what are the two biggest trends which are likely to have long-term impact? And when I think about it's impact both in the probability that something's likely to change and in terms of the impact in terms of how much change it will cause or how much disruption it will cause. And what I thought is the two are probably around this technology growth, like what will happen with technology. So we know from the 70s, Moore's Law, which said, the price of technology or the speed of a microprocessor will double every 2 years, and I think you added to that a little bit later, and the price will halve, which held all the way through till about 2003, 2004, and it fueled this huge growth in technology. And now we're at a different stage where technology is at a different stage, and it's more what we're doing with the technology when we're thinking about machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I think how fast that moves and how exponentially that moves will be quite interesting. And I think that's one of the big variables. It may be overpromised and overhyped, and it might just settle into its place along with other things that have come along as different fads over time. Or it might be something which really changes the way that we work, which we don't know, all right? And that's the future. It's unpredictable. And then the other, which may be a little bit controversial, is accreditation and thinking about who does the accreditation. And that might seem preposterous. Like, of course, universities do accreditation. But with all these players in the business market and with the power that business has over politics, if you think about that shift in the world, if you went back to the 60s and 70s, very much the politics dictated what happened in countries and businesses were subservient to politics. If you think about the 2008 financial crisis, it was very clear that business supersedes what politics do, and certainly in the US, which is our global leader in some respects that we look to, business is a much more powerful force. So the question would be, what happens with accreditation in education? So I mapped those out and I said, well, what happens if you put these on an axis and you say at the top you have exponential technology growth. It's a bit like Moore's Law with the microprocessor, but you have the ability for technology to increase its ability to learn and I'll divert for a minute and tell you a story. So one of the challenges we have with Get Smart is we market courses online. So we take adverts with Google Ads and Facebook and LinkedIn, and when people are looking for things for skills or jobs, our ad will pop up and they click on it. And we have almost too many people who click on them and they express some interest to the number of people we can phone, because physically phoning someone takes some time, but for somebody to click on something and fill in the details is quite quick. And so we have to make decisions about who we phone. And one of the most interesting things I've seen in the last year was one of our technologists, a software developer who we hired initially to do educational analytics, so basically to figure out who's going to drop off courses and how do we intervene before they drop off the course so that they don't drop off the course. So analyzing all the data of who posts on the forum, how active they are, have they handed in their assignments, a bunch of variables, and use machine learning to come up with techniques to say, okay, this person looks like Conrad's at risk of dropping off, so before he drops off, we'll phone him and say, can we help you with this? We see you struggling with an assignment. So we were building that system. But one of the problems we had in the other part of the business was the sales problem. And this guy, in his spare time at evening, wrote the system. And what he did is he took data last year, and he took the data from I think July through to September, and he used that as learning data, and he used machine learning techniques, which he said, if you go back even 2 years ago, we couldn't do this. It wasn't possible because we didn't have the technology, and the techniques, although the statistical techniques were known, it wasn't possible to actually implement them on software. It would take too long to run, but now with cloud services, you can write it and you can spawn up 15 servers to work on a problem very quickly. You don't have to run it on your own computer. Long story short, he built the system, and he said, if I now look, and he presented to us in November, if I look at what we did in terms of our sales over the month of October, November, halfway through the month, he said, we now know what we actually did in terms of who we phoned, whether they're the right person or the wrong person. And he said, with my system, I can also now go back and I can show what I would have predicted before we start. And the graph is remarkably similar. I can't show the data, obviously, but the graph is remarkably similar. And it struck me that these techniques, which are very new. They're really just at the embryonic stage, but they're coming into business. And in two contexts there, one in driving business and sales from that point of view, but the other in educational technology and trying to predict how a student is going to do well before they actually do it. And what's fascinating about it is I would think from you're actuary, so you have superior analytical skills to what I have, but I would think you would analyze a bunch of variables and we would apply those same variables to everyone in this room if you were all in a class, and we'd be able to predict an outcome. And in fact, they do something quite different, is they have a set of variables and they apply different variables to every person. And the computational techniques allow you to look at that particular set of variables for that person and then predict. And these are things like they arrived at our website using an iPhone 7 as opposed to an iPhone 6. Or they first made contact with us 6 weeks before as opposed to 8 weeks before the course start date. And as a result of these variables and numerous others, we had about 15, they could highly reliably predict what was happening. So I look at this and I go, wow, imagine what that could do. I mean, we have Siri on our phone, which learns our voice, and we have Google Maps, who figures out which routes we drive and starts to suggest things, which is applying these techniques. Imagine how that would look if we go forward to 2030. So that's on my vertical axis, exponential technology growth. And at the bottom, I've said more linear technology growth, which is, it obviously grows, technology will always develop. And then on the left and the right, I've said university and business. And let me explain that, because what this diagram gives us is it gives us four scenarios for what educational technology might look like in 2030. So the first is, if the combination of exponential technology, as I've spoken about, and universities being the primary accreditors of education, and it's obviously too simple to say it's one or the other, but it's useful to put on a continuum. If we say universities are the primary accreditors and this exponential technology, universities will need to reinvent themselves in terms of how they offer courses. It just won't work anymore to have 100 people or 30 or 400 people in a lecture theater lecturing to them and people physically coming to the space. And it's just not going to work like that. So the universities will have to reinvent themselves and think about how they operate. They'll also have to reinvent their business models in terms of how they make money, which for some universities is a difficult thing to do, particularly not the big, highest named universities in the world. So Purdue University in Kaplan, which is a private company in the U.S., is interesting because they've basically a public university bought a for-profit university because they realized that the for-profit university had something that they could benefit from together. So this kind of combination between public and private, which sounds preposterous from an academic point of view, but these things are happening. So how they reinvent themselves is a question. Obviously, from both a 2U and a Get Smarter perspective, we've seen universities, some are very keen. London School of Economics see short courses, maybe because they started and their roots were short courses 100 years ago. They see that as a huge opportunity, and they see that as a way of defining themselves in the market and experimenting with new ways of presenting material and thinking about it as the first interaction someone has with the university might be a short course, but over time they'll come in and they'll do an executive ed, and then maybe over time they might do something more substantial. So reinventing universities is the first scenario. On the opposite end is if business starts playing and making inroads into this world of accreditation, and I'll give you a concrete example of that in a minute, which we can see already with Get Smarter certificates. They're not accredited. It's not an NQF level. It's basically a piece of paper to say people have completed a course and they've done a piece of work at a certain level. But that has value in the marketplace, and that we know people write us stories to say, I went for my job interview and I used that and I got the job interview because I could show that I'd taken initiative and I'd learned something about project management or internet marketing. So employees are looking at this and employers are looking at this and they're saying, we can see that as some sort of proxy. Some universities have work-based learning recognition, which they will recognize it in a more tangible way. But if businesses start to play more in that role, it becomes, I think, a challenge for universities in some way, or maybe not, maybe they can work with it. If it's in this world of linear technology growth and not exponential technology growth, then I think it's probably more like it's a fad of sorts. It's kind of a business fad that comes and goes, and there will be another one, and there will be another one. So I don't see it as majorly disruptive over a long period of time, but I think it's interesting of how that plays out. So the first scenario, reinvent the university. The second scenario, the combination of businesses giving accreditation and linear technology growth is the next fad, please. The top right is the one which is, I think, quite challenging, which is if businesses really make inroads and that list of 90-plus companies, one or two or three of them become the Googles and the Facebooks, which really make inroads into education and can really play a role in education. So just think about this as a thought experiment. Already now you can go onto LinkedIn and you can say, I want to work in this field, in this city, and it'll tell you which university you should go to because it obviously has the data to match up the people from that university typically end up in that career in that city. If you think not too far ahead, LinkedIn could quite easily give accreditation to say this person, their skills have been confirmed from these courses that they've done, which may not be university courses, and the combination of it gives somebody who's highly employable in this area, because we know that, because we've got data which shows that there's 400 people in that area that are all employed with that combination of skills. The data is all there already. So you could imagine a private company making a real challenge to universities, offering something to employers who could say, this person has these skills, and the computer can vouch for those skills because we've got data to show that people with those skills from those different places can do this job at this level. It's a real challenge for an educational institution, an academic approach, which is just one single way of getting accreditation. And I've labeled it Moore's Law Corollary, which is the ability for computers to learn doubles about every 2 years, because I think it could be driven by people using technology in various ways, either selling or creating courses or creating learning environments online, which are very adaptive to the students that are in those environments. And then the fourth is the opposite of that, which would be that the universities really retain the accreditation. The technology doesn't grow as well, or as fast. And if you think about universities, and this is a counter-argument, and if you think these scenarios are contradictory, they purposely are contradictory because they pull in different directions. Universities are the oldest organizations on the planet. There's no organizations that are older. Maybe the Catholic Church. But I think if you think about universities, you know, El Caron in Morocco is 859 AD. University of Bologna, 1088, Oxford, 1096, Cambridge, 1209. These are very old institutions. Companies haven't lived this long. And that says two things. One, they are very resilient. And two, that they're not very adept to change. We are still doing things in the universities that we were doing 100 years ago. And you know, using similar, not too dissimilar technology, and they're quite slow to change in some way. So there is a scenario which, despite all the forces and pushes, you know, into this new world and growing technology, actually things, they change, but they change more incrementally than we think they might. What are the flags for these? So the flags are pretty much indicators. So if you saw the failure of many ed tech companies, you would see yourself pulling more towards the universities having more power in this accreditation game. If AI and machine learning, because it can be applied in so many broad fields, ends up being more applied to science and health, and education becomes a poor cousin for the application of AI and machine learning, perhaps that's the flag that says it's more linear rather than exponential. This is, if it is more exponential technology growth, just think about this again as a thought experiment. Does anyone use Audible to listen to audiobooks, or anyone listen to audiobooks? A couple of people. So you can listen to an audiobook now, so you can be driving in your car, and you can, if you frame it slightly differently, you can be downloading the information that's in that book, right? If it's fiction, it's for your interest and entertainment. If it's non-fiction, it's for your learning. So you can be listening to the book. And those who listen on Audible know you can listen at double speed if you want. So you could listen to the book at double speed, and there are people who actually listen at four times and five times the speed, and they're trying to absorb as much as they can. It's not too far a thought process to go, you know, we walk around with phones, somehow this technology gets almost mainstreamed into our brain, all right? So you almost end up with this kind of situation.
Not yet.
He asks, can you fly that helicopter?
Can you fly that thing? Not yet.
Okay, so it's a scene from The Matrix, which, when The Matrix came out in the 90s, you'd think far-fetched. Actually, now we walk around with a cell phone embedded almost in our palm all the time, which has huge amounts of intelligence in it. We can fast-forward our Audible books into our brain faster than we ever could before. Like, what else needs to happen? And perhaps that's the flag of saying that it pulls us across into this exponential technology growth. And then I mentioned LinkedIn. LinkedIn is interesting. They have a huge amount of data about both education, people, and jobs. And they are the natural person to pull those things together in some shape or form to offer accreditation. So I'm out of time, and I know I've spoken a little bit quickly, and I feel like I've downloaded quite a lot to you. But I'm hoping that although it's not specifically around what actuarial education looks like, you can start to think about what are the leaps that we need to think about from an actuarial point of view, and how do we adapt to that into this changing world of education technology. But let's open up if there are any comments, thoughts, questions. Need a microphone.
We've got one here.
There you go, Vinegar.
I guess the question that comes to my mind straight away is a lot of this is based on a first world technology environment. My understanding is that we get in South Africa many students coming into the tertiary education space who have maybe interacted with a cell phone but not really used Excel, not used Word, not used a computer on a table or a laptop. And so technology-dependent education would not fit a South African context. Have you got any thoughts or comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in that, is it Steve? Yes. Yeah, I mean, your comment, or Joe, you might have said about disadvantaged students, I can't remember. Yeah, it's interesting in that I think of it slightly differently, because I think with the 10 years of business science students, and I'm seeing them in the fourth year only, I'm constantly surprised disadvantaged or advantaged students, the lack of skills generally in technology around Excel. And I don't know actuarial students 5 years post, but I know accounting students, because we've done a project with Mazars for years, and I know the quality of students arriving in Mazars who've got a CA qualification, who you would think should be very adept at Excel, generally not. And so for me, it's almost a bigger problem, not so much about where you're from or disadvantaged advantages. It is about access. So that I would concur, that who has access to technology. But, I mean, there have been fascinating experiments where, I mean, it's not hard. If you think about a simple laptop could be 3,000 or 4,000 rand, and the universities could be a place where people get exposed to it. But there's something else that's missing in that, and it's something about, I come from a software development background where almost most people who've done well have taught themselves in some way, and there's something about that which we're missing somewhere. I've got a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old, and I'm going, like, how do you get them to engage? Because I think when people engage themselves, it doesn't matter if they come out of a township or they come out of Bishop's Court or Sandton or whatever, they will figure it out themselves and they'll learn it, and somehow that doesn't get through our system. So even by fourth year, I'm perplexed sometimes.
I just want to comment on that. I think you're right about the Excel and all that, but I think what you're wrong about is that that's not technology anymore. They skip that level. They skip the computer. They're very technology adept on the phone, but they skip that, and it's the massa of software, really. Like, you know, nobody goes there anymore. They're just going straight through. But I don't think that means we don't get tech. I mean, I think it just means that we can't think of Excel as a tech application. We need to think of stuff that's going to come via the phone or via smaller, more sort of agile gadgets.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Many people building systems with cell phones for learning, which are chat-based almost, to try and get into that millennial mindset where people do Snapchat and WhatsApp most of their life, and it's interacting with a tutor in a chat format, which they adapt to very easily, surprisingly enough.
So to me, the problem has two facets to it. What I'm interested in is what technology we teach our students rather than what technology we use to teach our students. Mm. Because I'm increasingly convinced of two things. One, our students are slow at adapting to new things than previous generations. So I'm amazed at how when we change the operating system of the students, so we change our students from using their school-based calculators to reverse Polish on HP12C, they adapt to that much more slowly than 20 years ago. They're much more set in their ways. Yeah. But the second thing that's related to that is that a university is not meant to teach people a technique per se, but rather how to think and to do high-level things around adapting to change. And if we get that right, what we discover, our students embrace new technology when they move into the workplace very, very quickly. One of the reasons our students from disadvantaged backgrounds don't do as well initially is that they don't have a continuous exposure. So you can teach people something, but if they're only using the computers while they're on campus, while they're in the formal system, they're not living on it, that knowledge isn't cemented. And if you think about everyone and how they learn, you actually learn something when you have to live in it afterwards. So I'm not convinced that an enormous amount needs to change. But I will give you one thing. When our maths school thought that they were really ahead of time, and they moved people onto Pearson Labs to do maths online several years ago. The quality of maths dropped dramatically because it took away the students' need to struggle. Because if you got something wrong on the machine twice, it gave you a hint. And the third time it was wrong, they showed you how to do it, because that's what the computer does. And the students learned to game that. And so they didn't go through the learning process. And studies around the world show that most technology may go faster, but humans still learn at the same pace that they used to, because our brains haven't got faster. In fact, they might have got slower. I don't know.
And that's more distracted, maybe. Yeah.
And there are many more distractions.
Yeah.
And the thing is, as well, at the moment, I think a lot of what happens with technology, and you talked about it, is we are selecting out the people who are best able to learn on technology. Okay, and we'll get wonderful results, but it's not scalable. Because as soon as you have to go to a full population, you'll discover that those that didn't respond well to the technology, how do we get to them and how do we teach them?
Good. Thanks, Steve. Rizan.
Well, just to make a comment as well, and I think this leads quite, Steve's comment leads into Ashley's session as well, because which is more about, you know, what technology do we teach in the, do we include in our curriculum? But I also wanted to ask you the question about assessment.
Yes.
As to how, because I mean, there's always the argument about how effective the examination-based assessment, a written examination-based assessment is. I mean, we're quite advanced in that we actually allow students to type their exams on a computer. But, but I guess that's a point as well. It's not just about the teaching, it's also about how do you assess that the skills have been mastered, if you know what I'm saying, as opposed to just that the material has been learnt.
Yeah, and it's tricky from a number of counts, and it's got pros and cons with technology, I suppose, because you can do it on scale easier and more people, but some things are harder to assess. So it's hard to assess more the qualitative things than the quantitative, and you can't just assess somebody on quantitative. And then there's issues around security and identity theft and things like that, which are tricky, but there are things coming out which the proctoring and identifying people even by their keystrokes. We all apparently have a very unique keystroke pattern, so literally how you type identifies you. So there's systems that can identify you based on that. What's interesting, I think, from the technology, and I touched on it, was the assessment side, when you can start using the assessment data to identify. So you think about Khan Academy, they kind of reversed this flipped classroom idea of saying, instead of, well, he talks about, and he says, rather than what we do is we allow everyone to get 70 or 80%, and as long as they get 70 or 80%, we pass them. But what happens to that 20%? Because it accumulates over time, and at some point, it's a train wreck when that 20% becomes a few key things together which a person just doesn't know. So you've got to get to 100% knowledge of it. So what you do is you do the 80%, and then you make sure they get the 20%, and technology allows you to identify that and focus on it. And it also allows the teachers to then use the technology to identify who the students are struggling the most and focus on them to bring them up to speed while streamlining the ones that are at the head of the class. A combination, which I think lies an answer to a lot of the things with education technology. Technology on its own seldom solves everything, but a combination of the two and this clever use of technology where you can let the technology do what it does well and you can let humans do what they do well, which is nurturing somebody and helping them or challenging them to get them to struggle based on the assessment results is probably a better solution.
Oh, thank you. Is it on? Okay, yes. Mine actually is just a comment. I think the first part of it is covered by the gentleman over there. My comment was just to say that how do universities structure the curriculum and the syllabus in a way that it enables us to be able to I mean, looking at the fact that as you were mentioning that the universities, I mean the entire spectrum is changing in terms of technology. How do universities structure the syllabus and the curriculum in a way that it is in conjunction with how and the speed at which technology is moving, but at the same time not compromising the standard and the quality and the credibility of the profession itself? Because I think one of the reasons why we go out in the field and not be actually not comfortable coming back into the academia is mainly because of such trends that are ever changing, because by the time you go back, the world has changed altogether. So it becomes very difficult for you to come in and try to adjust again. So yeah, that is just my comment.
Yeah, I think that's very valid. I mean, it highlights why we have the work-based learning.
We have work-based learning as part of our framework. Yes. In a way, it kind of, I mean, I said to Peter there, in a way that open loop structure is almost how the actual exams work.
Right.
You know, that you get a base amount of knowledge in terms of the full-time study, and then, you know, you go out and you're working and you're writing the exams, and it's pretty much how long it takes you to master the information, you know.
Right.
So in a way, that is kind of like
an
open loop kind of structure.
I mean, it does sound like that, yeah, that is very close to that. I mean, not actuarially, but generally education, it's interesting, it's structured almost separately. Like there's an academic portion and then you're done, and then you must go and learn in the workplace.
Whereas
if you think about it all as one, it's much more powerful. Yeah.
Yeah.